podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This episode of Red Inca, we talk about whether Ireland would have been better off not playing at Lord's at all with a man who believes they shouldn't have.
Nathan Johns, journalist with the Irish Times.
We talk shirt sponsors, pinch blockers, two-day tests, postmen, Islanders, New Zealand, first-class structures, and why making runs at Lord's just counts for more to casual fans. You came up to me and Tim Wigmore in the Lord's press box, sort of sidled up in a sort of slightly dodgy way, as you do, and you said that Ireland shouldn't have played their test match at Lord's. And I think at the time you were basically already workshopping a piece and you're doing that dodgy thing that journalists do where they pretend they've got like a fresh opinion, but actually they've already been working on it. Is that your contention? If I made you state your case, is that what you would say, that you think that Ireland shouldn't have played that test match at Lord's? Am I representing you correctly?
I think so, from a cricketing perspective, yes. And I did that thing that now that I actually, as an Irish cricket journalist, you don't necessarily always have a full press box. So to have wonderful people to bounce ideas off, I think that was a process of however dodgily I sidled up to you.
That's such a slight on Justin and Gare and all those guys who were there every week.
No, it's not a slight on them. It's not a slight on them. It's the fact that I don't necessarily go to, like, for example, Ian Callender, I think, is the only guy who follows them around the world. I don't get to do that. I go to tournaments and stuff, but no, it's not a slight on those guys at all. And I have great chats with Justin about the intricacies of interpro cricket and why are there 8 South African-born players playing for a certain team instead of Irish every week. But I think when you speak to people and you say, you shouldn't be here, you shouldn't be at Lord's, a lot of people's instant reactions go, oh, how dare you say that? You can never turn down an occasion at Lord's. And I shopped the opinion to a few people, actually. I did say it to a few of the Irish guys, and they were kind of like, ooh, be careful. I think it's from a cricketing perspective. They finished the game when? Saturday, 6 days later, on Friday, they're flying to Zimbabwe for what Andrew Balbirnie said is the most important tournament of his captaincy cycle, and that is to try and qualify for the World Cup in India. And it's going to be a brutal qualifier. They have to play Zimbabwe in their own conditions. Sri Lanka are there. West Indies are there, which, well, doesn't hold any fear for Ireland, but it's still the West Indies are at a qualifying event. The Dutch and the Scots are there, obviously, with no county players. But, you know, depending on who you talk to, Nepal are planning a heist. So it's going to be a really brutal tournament. And the build-up to this test was all about the Irish camp saying this isn't the pinnacle event. It's why we're not picking Josh Little and we're resting him. You know, it's that was why the pinnacle event came out initially. It was around the Little stuff. But if it wasn't the pinnacle event, why are you spending the week before you travel in a damage limitation exercise and a face-saving exercise against the best side in a format that you don't really play, or at least the form side in a format you don't really play, instead of going to Zimbabwe and playing a 3-game ODI series against Nepal in Bulawayo at 9 o'clock in the morning when the ball is doing God knows what and you've no idea what the pitch is like. From a pure cricketing preparation, I just didn't see the value of when you have a so-called pinnacle event coming up, staying at Lord's. So that was my perspective on it. And so, there's a lot of off-field reasons, yeah, which I'm sure you're going to throw at me.
We'll get to all that. So I wrote, I think the day before you came up and talked to me, I wrote a video where I basically went through how Ireland had batted very poorly. And at the top, I said that obviously the best case scenario would have been that for them not to play in this test match. But you can't not play in the test match, right? And part of the reason is, and we can go in, we'll go into all the different reasons. But the very basic one is that international cricket runs as a bilateral system, right? So if England clearly wanted this game as a warm-up, like, it wasn't an accident that it is where it is on the schedule, right? It could have been in other parts of the schedule. They put it in as a very good warm-up against a team that they probably thought was, you know, well, they're probably hoping was going to be slightly higher quality. Probably hoped Josh Little was going to play, for instance. But from the bowling perspective, the warm-up wasn't very good. But from a batting perspective, I think at times the Ireland team held up and they had to try a few different things. And England actually ended up, you know, allowing way more runs than they should have. So from a warm-up perspective, that went very well. But I think the most important thing is Ireland spent a decade telling everyone that they wanted to play Test cricket. They were desperate to play Test cricket. It was, go back and listen to every time William Porterfield had a microphone in front of him, right? You know, all those things. Warren Dutram couldn't, you could ask Warren Dutram what he wanted for breakfast and he'd say, I'd like Ireland to play Test cricket. You can't then do all of that and then get a Test match at Lord's, because it is Lord's. It's so symbolic in that. And don't get me wrong, I'm more than happy to slag off Lord's at any time, but it's a symbolic Test place and then not play there. I think just from the pure symbolism of everything Irish cricket has tried to do over the last, you know, decade and a half, and the fact that it is Lord's, it would have made them look a little bit stupid if they just said, do you know what? We're going to Zimbabwe next week, so we're probably going to skip this, especially since you've got IPL players flying in from India who are about to play in a World Test Championship. Like, if you want to talk about not preparing for something, like, kind of no one in world cricket is ever prepared for anything ever anymore.
Yeah, which is an interesting point. I guess it's partly the preparation aspect and partly just the kind of galling nature of how those Irish players were just completely thrown to the wolves during the week. All the lack of Red Bull, domestic and international, is, you know, it's been well documented, but doing so and going out to Bangladesh and surviving so you don't lose by an innings because Thorpe and Tucker has a day out and hits 100, and McBrien gets six for, or likewise in Sri Lanka, they still lost by the end innings twice in Sri Lanka, but at least they had one day where I think Balbirnie got 95, Sterling got 100, Camphor got 100, Tector got 85 in the second innings or whatever it was. Like, you're getting these individual performances to kind of almost make it worthwhile. You're like, oh, guys are getting Test match hundreds. It's good for their, you know, morale, and it's good for their stats, whatever. But that just felt like it was always unlikely this week. And yes, two or three guys maybe missed out on hundreds on day three at Lord's. But it's just sitting there watching them on day two, you're going, why is this attack being asked to do what they're doing when everyone and his dog knew that they just didn't have the wicket-taking ability in red ball cricket to go up against Bangladesh? And Bangladesh are still a good side, but Bangladesh or Sri Lanka, let alone England at home. And that was what sat with me. And then you look at what's going on off the field. They don't want to annoy the ECB, right? That's the other part. You can say, no, beggars can't be choosers. And there's the prospect of getting England over to Malahide anytime soon isn't really on the table, but it wouldn't be on the table for 10 years if they pissed off the ECB. They had a shirt sponsor this week. They don't normally have one because they said, oh, you've got a game at Lord's. The Sky cameras are there. And by all accounts, they were very, very happy with being front and center, even though the performance was disappointing. So,
but that's a big thing because you know, we talk about the lack of Red Bull cricket and the lack of funding in Irish cricket. That sponsor is paying for staff members or, you know, facilities or wherever that money is going to go. All those things do count. Like, it's easy for you and I as cricket people to sit here and go, oh, they should put the cricket first. But they're going to have more money, perhaps, when it comes to maybe for helping them qualify for the World Cup, or more money if they do qualify for the World Cup to prepare better because of that shirt sponsor, right? Like, that these aren't accidental things. And then also, if the shirt sponsor liked them, who's the shirt sponsor? It's like a money transferring company.
I think is it clear currency? I think. It's, yeah.
So if they like what happens at Lord's and like, this is not about clear currency, just because I don't want to sound like what I'm going to say will sound very bad for cricket sponsors. But when you're a cricket sponsor, a lot of it is usually what happens is one person at the company who has the budget really likes cricket, right? And so they get the opportunity not only to sponsor the Irish cricket team, which is cool, and they get some memorabilia, and they'll have, you know, Belbo and Josh Little sign something for them or anything like that, but they'll also get a very nice box. They'll get treated very well by, you know, Ireland, probably. Maybe the ECB will pop over there as well to help Ireland out, all that sort of stuff. It's a big thing. And then, and I'm using your words because you told me this before we talked, but they also want that same sponsor for the India matches, right? And again, it would be a very big thing, although maybe a slightly worse box at Malahide than you get at Lord's. But all of those things do count. And that if they get the sponsor for this test, and that then means they get the sponsor for India, and then the clear currency or anyone goes, oh, wait a minute, it's worth sponsoring, that could end up being, you know, a couple of $100,000 a year. It might end up being a couple of $1 million, you know, over a few years and everything else. That's real money that allows Irish cricket to develop better. Like, I understand why it annoys you because you see it as an off-field thing, but all that money does eventually come back to on-field.
So the networking is important. I think, you know, I write in the piece, you know, it's a glorified networking event, which, you know, sounds very disparaging, but I go on to say, yeah, that's all important. Like I completely acknowledge all of this. I just don't think, there's kind of two things. First of all, it's just particularly galling to use the players and cricket players are pawns for boards to make money. Like that's, you know, everyone knows that, but it's particularly galling to see that in the context of what happened at Lord's this week and the fact that the game could easily have finished inside 2 days. In terms from a saving face point of view, like I said, it's kind of embedded into the nature of being an Irish cricketer that you don't have any facilities and you don't have top quality domestic structures. You're never going to be as well prepared for international cricket as anyone else, or at least other full members. Maybe Zimbabwe, you can have that conversation. But so they always have one hand tied behind their back. This just felt like going too far and doing it primarily because of all those other reasons. That was the priority this week. And also, you know, giving fans a day out at Lord's, and the players were happy to be there. And, you know, some of those guys might not play at Lord's ever again. You just don't know. And that was particularly galling. And then equally, there was the consistency, because it's the most striking example of them underpreparing their players for other reasons. And then just it's consistency. Okay. Yeah. They alienated so many people by saying Lords is not a pinnacle event. And I respected their honesty. I was asked about this on BBC the other day, and I said, look, we're slating Cricket Ireland here because they're being too honest for their own good. And maybe they just weren't used to having an English style press pack hounding them and constantly throwing their words back at them in press conferences. So maybe next time they come to Lords, they won't be giving such quotable or headline ready phrases to throw back at them. But when you do that, and you say this is not a pinnacle event, it's just completely not consistent to say, oh, well, the cricket's the most important thing, and that's why Josh Little is not playing, because he needs to rest and he has to go to Zimbabwe fresh. And then to go, oh, but everyone else can play because we need to get a few hundred K or whatever they made from this test match and stay on side with the ECB. It's just, there's always that balance, and I appreciate that. I'm not saying they should have necessarily, it's ever one or the other. Just for me, the balance, they didn't get it right this week.
So it's a bad test match. I do wonder how much things would have changed if they bowled first in those conditions, bowled England out for 250 or 260 in 12 overs.
Oh, they never would have bowled them out for
in
that.
12 overs. No, but if England were going to go hard, the ball was doing a lot in that first session off the pitch, right? And then that second session, it swung a lot, right? Those are two things that could, you know, if Adair had got it right and Hume, you know, if they would have run down the wicket at Hume and tried to smack it back over his head a bunch of times, there would have been opportunities. But I do think if they had the better of the conditions, it would be a slightly different conversation. But I'm going to put it to you that, and I don't really believe much in, like, you know, the theory of Lords. I don't care about Lords any more than any other cricket crumb. But certainly in Ireland, for casual fans, Lords is a name they know. Right? Your newspaper editors who don't care about cricket, I'm not saying they don't, but if they didn't, they would absolutely know what Lords is. And most people, you know, if they have, you know, even any knowledge of cricket, have heard the word Lords before, right? It's a bad test match, but Mark Adair and Andy McBrien can, for the next, you know, 50 years of their life, talk about that incredible partnership that they played at Lords, where they, you know, made England bat again. And it might sound silly, but, you know, you go back in cricket history and there are times when India and New Zealand had those kinds of partnerships that people would talk about for decades afterwards, because everyone knew they were by far the worst team. So that isn't quite the same as if Ireland were playing a test match in Cardiff, right? Or if Ireland were playing somewhere else. There is something about that Lord's nature. So of all the test matches to walk away from, I think that's the most tricky one. But I want to focus on the other side of this, which is tests are bilateral. And you said before that, you know, part of the reason that they want to play here is because they want to play in Malahide. And that's when we had the conversation in the press box. That was my first thing that I said to you, is the reason people almost never say no to test series when they're asked, and this, it doesn't matter how small the nation is or how big the nation is because eventually they want that team to come and tour them. Right. And if you have England touring in Malahide, let's say because it's England, they bring in a slightly bit bigger grandstand than normal, if that's possible. I know there's a lot of trees in Malahide and everything has to be shuffled around. But I'm pretty sure I've been there when there's been 12 or 14,000 people. Let's say they get to 12 or 14,000 people capacity. It's a 4-day test match. there's a bunch of Barmy Army, but just casual England fans were like, wait, we get to spend a weekend in Malahide or Dublin. Like, of course we're going to go over for a test match. Suddenly that creates something, perhaps also creates something that England like, where they can go over to Ireland at any time and play a really cool warm-up against, you know, decent opposition. Ireland have the ability to start marketing that, you know, better and better going ahead, you know, getting more fans and everything else. The Irish Tourism Board would obviously be massively excited by all of these sorts of things. That doesn't happen at all. If Ireland say, we're going to the World Cup next the week after, we can't come and play you at Lords, because England are going to be like, we offered you a test at Lords and you wouldn't come. That's not how cricket boards work. I just don't think there would be any conversation that would ever mean that Ireland were in a good position when it comes to getting England coming to them again. And I know what you will say, which is that Ireland may not make any money from that test match if England come over, but you also eventually want India to come over, right? You also want Australia to come over. You want the major teams to come over. Do you really want to annoy one of the three major teams at this time? Anyway, I've already said all this to you before off air, but so you will have such a great rebuttal to this now.
Well, yeah, 100%. I mean, beggars can't be choosers. That's the story of Cricket Ireland. As I acknowledged before, the off-field stuff, you know, I don't really have, you know, we're cricket guys. I don't necessarily have that much of an interest in that, and I can't win the argument on that. I would never go and say, you know, it was a useless exercise because to go and schmooze the ECB this week, or to schmooze a new jersey sponsor that might boost the cash because the new ICC money isn't going to come in until next year, and Ireland still potentially have a World Cup to travel to, and, you know, maybe a test match in Zimbabwe at the back end of the year, which is going to be expensive to travel down to. So I think that's all completely valid, completely fair. My point is just they were always balancing that. They're always balancing the needs of that versus best preparing their players for international cricket, which they don't do anyway. And then this week was the worst example of that. And when you put all that together, I was just angry. I sat there, I just was feeling so sorry for the players. They were put in the situation they are. And that makes it sound like that they're terrible players. And I need to be careful not to insult them there. And they're not, you know, as they saw on day three, some of those guys can more than hold a bat and can score.
The batting certainly held up. Even on that first day when they struggled, I think there were certainly still signs that there was decent batting within there. They just, what happens quite often in England when the ball's moving around early on, they lost too many early wickets, right? And they couldn't pull themselves back. But the batting held up in this test match. The bowling did not.
Oh, well, and again, it was always what was going to happen. You would have got really good money on Ireland, but I'm betting that Ireland would not take more than 5 wickets against this English attack on a flat pitch that Stokes wants, because, you know, he wants Rhodes to bowl quick bowlers to, even though they're all injured. So I don't want to insult the players here, because I don't want to throw into them wolves to the wolves makes it sound like they never had a hope in hell. But, you know, the captain is sitting there going, first of all, in the press conference at the end of day three, he's saying, yeah, this isn't preparation for Zimbabwe. It's completely different. We're playing at 9 a.m. in Bulawayo, not 11 o'clock on a Baswell Road in a 3-day game. The stakes are so much lower. And equally, he's saying, you know, we love to be here and all that. And just, there's just all this constant, it just, the conditions, it just, it's all very incongruous, or if I said that right. And the off-field stuff is vital, and that's really important. And Ireland, of all teams, have to balance that, and Ireland, the Irish players, have to be pawns, because they just don't get these opportunities. To get a Lord's Test and 3 T20s against India in the same year is massive, and the players just have to put up with that and go, yeah, well, but at least we're playing at Lord's, even if we're being used here, and that's fine. It just felt this was the most galling example of that, and I just was watching there genuinely gutted for someone like Fionn Hand or whoever it was, that he was asked to run in and bowl when he's not equipped to do so, because he's a young guy who's played 2 first class games, and he's got, you know, Ben Duckett and Ollie Pope just looking at him going, where am I going to score my runs? I'll just pick what I want. And that was kind of the emotive side. It's from the point of view of the players. The off-field stuff, it's all important, and that probably does completely does nullify the fact that I'm saying they shouldn't have played that game. But I think from a cricketing point of view, it was just the fact it was such a difficult watch, and the fact that they saved face on day 3 probably doesn't help my point, because like, oh, but look, it wasn't that bad. It was fine. But, you know,
they didn't lose by an innings. They lost only by 10 wickets.
but it's once again, it's Cricket Ireland being bailed out of massive, significant embarrassment
by two tail enders.
By by guys who have individual performances that they can't have. Mm. And that's, again, I think that's the story of Irish cricket, because the players are not going to ones going to be embarrassed. They'll say they are, but at the end of the day, if England won inside 2 days and batted the way they did and they are against an unprepared Irish attack, that's not a slight on the players. It's a slight on those preparing them. Mm. And once again, they got away with it while also getting all the benefits of the off-field stuff at Lord's, which doesn't sit well.
So I'm going to throw something slightly different at you. I think there was a few people, myself included, that were like, Ireland isn't going to get many test matches, right? They're just not going to play as many test matches as other teams are going to play. And most of the money in world cricket at the moment is coming via white ball opportunities, right? And Ireland made their name playing white ball cricket, not red ball cricket, right? But, you know, it's such a ridiculous sport now that we give test status to someone who's done well in white ball tournaments. But, you know, from Sri Lanka on up, we've been doing that for a long time now. So that's the model. You do well enough in a couple of World Cups, chances are you might end up with test status now. I felt that there was a long period of time where Ireland did focus a lot on test cricket and then didn't play any, you know, so setting up the first class system. When did they pivot to basically saying white ball cricket is now the pinnacle rather than red ball cricket?
It was during COVID when
no one would play them.
No one would play them. They didn't have any money. So they go, right, are we going to organize a six match or whatever it was, first class structure for the summer when we're going to lose money on it and try to get a couple of test matches somewhere when, you know, not that many people were playing test match cricket during COVID. And they just turned around and said, look, how are we going to make any money by qualifying for World Cups and getting TV revenues from that? And let's go all in on that, which is interesting because they developed a pretty good ODI side, but they were still pretty average as a T20 side. And it was only post-2021, post-Namibia disaster, that they turn around and kind of, look, the narrative around that side is they all of a sudden, oh, we need to be aggressive in T20 cricket, which to me is a complete load of nonsense because they're not idiots. They didn't all of a sudden lose to Namibia and wake up and go, oh, we have to score loads of boundaries and take loads of wickets in T20 cricket. But a new coach came in, he kind of coached a lot more white ball, like coached, I think it was Auckland Aces was his kind of franchise team, so to speak, over in New Zealand in Milan. And they kind of developed a slightly more attacking style, and all of a sudden they played, but what also helped was they played 10-20 T20s in one calendar year.
Yeah.
And by the time, which they never did before, and by the time they got to Australia for that World Cup, they were in a good position. They needed an individual to stand up in Camford to bail them out of trouble against Scotland, but then they went on and hammered the West Indies and got a rain win in England. So the strategy has by and large worked. They've become a decent T20 side. They are a good ODI side that can't win close games, which is frustrating because that's why they're in Zimbabwe. They missed out on so many points. I mean, last year, I think they lost two of their Super League games to New Zealand, one by one wicket, one by one run. So arguably they shouldn't be at these qualifiers, but by and large, it worked. The strategy worked. They said, we need to make money and to survive as a board. We need to get as much white ball cricket in because nobody's playing test cricket and we can't afford to have a domestic structure. They still can't afford to have a domestic structure, but because they've got offers of playing away from home that cost them nothing, they're saying, oh, there's no harm. And my point is there was no harm in doing it in Bangladesh and Sri Lanka where A, there were fewer eyeballs and B, it was months out from anything that was important. Whereas this Lord's one, there was a little bit of harm.
Yeah, the whole first class thing's really interesting because obviously, you know, sort of when Cricket Island become Cricket Island, you know, their whole plan straight away is to have their own first class structure. And it makes sense because I don't think you can ever be a successful nation if you are playing your players through county cricket, because we've already seen Scotland, Netherlands can't even use them when in the height of their summer, right?
But that was never an issue for Ireland. To be fair to them, they have, I mean, the performance director, Richard Holdsworth, used to work in county cricket. They have some excellent relationships with the counties, and there were never any high profile, we can't get our guys for games. It was an issue in that sometimes a county contract might have been, oh, well, he's going to be away for 2 months of the season playing for Ireland. But by and large, I think the networking, I'm giving out to them for networking at Lord's, but the networking with the counties back in the day was good enough that off the top of my head, I don't think there were any high profile emissions. What's happening to the Dutch now and the Scots now never happened.
But what actually happens then is those players filter in through the England side, right? So you do lose players, you just lose them in a different way, right? You lose your best players in a way that Scotland and the Netherlands aren't losing their players because they're going to go on and play for England. So there's still a downside. The other downside is that you can't develop any of your players when they're in county cricket, right? So if you want, if you want Graham Hume to be a first change bowler and start bowling more seam, well, that's not why he's got a contract in county cricket. He's got a contract to bowl swing up front, right? Like if you want Andy McBride to bat at number three in List A cricket because you need a pinch blocker, no county team's ever going to have Andy McBride at number three in their one-day team. So you can't develop players in the same way. If you're forfeiting control over those players, and then you're hoping that your system is so good. So it's not just that they may not be available, it's that you can't develop them the way that you want. This is someone who's worked for Cricket Scotland. I can tell you that these things happen all the time.
But they struggle to do that anyway. This year, it might be slightly different because they've got some new coaches into their own domestic provincial setup. But like last year, there were loads of examples of somebody would pick up the phone to a provincial head coach, say, this guy needs to bat at three, or this guy needs to bowl four overs or whatever. And the coach would go, well, no, he doesn't fit into our side like that, so we're not doing that. and this is an interprovincial system where there's four teams and no one really cares who wins. The players probably do because they're competitive beasts. The coaches do because it looks good. And some of these coaches probably are trying to get into the national setup at some point. But by and large, the people watching these games just, want to watch the Irish players do well and figure out who's the 19-year-old that's going to be in the side this time next year or whoever it is. And that's what the Interpros are for. And publicly, they've said, yeah, if we want a guy, like the example last year was Gareth Delaney was, batting three in the T20 side nationally and becoming their leg spin option. So he needed to bat high up the order and bowl four overs every game in his domestic stuff, and that wasn't necessarily the case. Or in 50-over cricket, he didn't always get the ball 10 overs. That's just one example. There was quite a few. This year, I think, is slightly better. Like, for example, so PJ Moore used to open the batting in 50-over cricket, and he got a phone call saying, you need to bat five because that's where we see you, even though he's opening a test cricket. But that's where we see you in white ball cricket. So he's now batting five for his province, Munster. So I think it is working slightly, but they've never had full control over what the provincial coaches do.
Yeah, but there's still a big difference between that, which happens everywhere. Like, do you know what I mean? There are Sheffield Shield coaches that are going to do that. There's a big difference between that and, you're calling up the coach of Derby, and the coach of Derby is just like, well, we own this player. So I get your point. The thing that I would say is that what they were trying to do makes sense. This building this first class system and having everything else, but the problem is that it's a minor counties level, right? At best, probably. And in future, it's like, the best players are probably going to go off more and more anyway. Like if you, the next great 16-year-old Irish player is probably, at 19, maybe playing in fringe franchise tournaments, right? Like, it's not the same kind of system and this is through no fault of Cricket Ireland. They were setting up a system for what existed 10 years ago, and it's already changed, and they already don't have the money to make it as good as they want. And I'm not sure there's 60 good players in Ireland that allow for that system to ever be at that level. And even if there was 60 good players at Ireland, we know that, if you take the international players away and then three or four others who, for various reasons, you might get some of the older players will go back to county cricket when they're a little bit more senior because they want to cash in on the end of their career, or they might go off to T20 cricket or whatever that may be. It means at any one time, your first class system or your domestic system, whatever you want to call it, is going to be even weaker than you can ever make it. So I don't know how it ever gets to the level where it's strong enough to prepare these players for what, like the leap before Mark Adair, he's played a couple of games for Warwickshire, right? I think that's right.
Yeah, he's a second team player for them by and large. Yeah.
So he played a couple of games for Warwickshire. He's basically going from a very, very low first class competition in Ireland to having to bowl to, England in a test match at Lord's, as you said, on a flat wicket. Well, flat by the time he bowled on it, surely. that's not particularly, how do you make that leap? Like it's a huge ask of those players, right?
Well, the counter to that is since the end of county cricket for Irish players, they've produced two guys who could be world-class and one who has a really good record. In Tector Little and Tucker. Mm-hmm. So that's the counter.
My counter, counter is that that is because more people in Ireland are playing cricket and there is more of a professional structure in general. And there are now job opportunities. Like if you, 20 years ago, Josh Little and Harry Tector and Lorcan Tucker still existed, right? But they might've gone off to get other jobs. And so that's because Irish cricket exists. I'm not saying that the development of their younger players hasn't helped and everything else, but I don't think specifically the domestic system, Josh Little is left arm and bowls 90 miles an hour. I don't think we could say that domestic Irish cricket developed that. Do you know?
They got really lucky with him because he bowls 90 miles an hour because he played hockey and he's really strong wrists and he has this like real snappy thing he does with his wrists. That's why that happened. Ireland hasn't got an amazing record at developing 90 mile an hour bowlers. So I don't think they can claim too much credit for that. And equally, the Tector and Tucker thing is just because, age 23, Harry Tector has played 94 games for Ireland because that's just where he learned. Whereas I think Harry Brook, who's the same age as him, has played 23 games for England at the same age. So that's what that has happened. So look, they're doing just about enough to keep their heads above water with getting young players into the side early and then figuring out if they can sink or swim. And then once they do swim, they turn out to be pretty good because they've learned at international level and they can kind of keep accelerating. But you're completely right. The domestic, those are the best guys. How do they develop the next tier without kind of getting the passport players or the eligibility players who stay there for 3 years? How do they develop those guys who are coming up who don't have that talent and they need to play against some pretty good county standard bowlers, to someone like James McCollum, right? We were talking about this. He scored, what was the wagon wheel you put in your notes piece the other day? He scores like 35% of his runs through cover or something like that, which is double what he does anywhere else, right? He's a good player. He's got a good technique. He's got a good defense, got a really nice cover drive. He looks $1 million when he plays it, but he hasn't got another shot. Whereas if he goes over and plays second for Derby for a few seasons in second division or whatever, he'll develop a second and third shot and can probably average 30 opening the batting for Ireland in Test cricket. But he hasn't been able to do that because A, there's no red ball cricket, and B, if there was, he hasn't got anyone good enough bowling to him that's going to test whether he can play the pull shot or test whether he can develop a drive down the ground.
Yeah, he's not going to face Josh Little, is he? Do you know what I mean?
So, no.
It's such an interesting system and how they come out of it. I just think that even though I agree with the premise of your piece, there's no doubt that the players are thrown in. But if the overall impact of them playing at Lords is positive for Irish cricket going into the future, then that's kind of the player's lot, right? It's a bit like, let's go back to Andy McBrien, since he's made runs this week, right? We all know he shouldn't be batting up the order. He doesn't have the skills required to be batting up the order. Odean Smith almost killed him. He's not used to facing 90 mile an hour bowlers on flat hard pitches, all those sorts of things. But that's what happens to athletes. Sometimes you just get thrown in to situations you can't do because your team needs somebody. I mean, NBA finals are on this week and you've got, a 6'5" guy, trying to stop a 6'10" guy because the team doesn't have, in Miami, he doesn't have enough tall players and he knows he's going to get beaten up, right? He knows before this game, he's going to be made to look small. He's going to get beaten up. Andy McBrien knew he was going to get hit a lot. He knew he was going to get a lot of short pitch bowling, all those sorts of things. That is part of being a professional athlete at times. And Ireland is coming at this from a position of weakness. Like they are where they are on the table. And we know that as great as Irish cricket can be, I mean, the way that Warren Dutram always sold it to me back in, over a decade ago was, what if we're the next New Zealand, right? And he wasn't, that was before New Zealand was as good as they have been the last couple of years, of course. But his thing was, you go into Australia and then you might put a couple of tests on against New Zealand on the back end of it. They're very realistic of where Irish cricket is. I think Belbo said in his interview the other day that he was hoping that, Irish cricket could get to the fourth or the fifth biggest sport in Ireland. Like everyone knows where Irish cricket is. And sometimes that means that there are going to be teams thrown out into situations that they shouldn't be in. That is kind of where they are. Like I don't think you can give them a much cushier ride. Even throwing them to Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, those are tough test series for good teams.
I agree. But once again, they're completely relying on players bailing them out of trouble. Because if that game finishes inside 2 days, which at one point people were worried about, do Ireland ever get asked back to Lords in the near future? Does England go, why do we think this is a valuable warm-up exercise for the Ashes? Yeah, okay, we got decent board relations with these guys. They came to, we gave them a box. You know, it might be nice for us to go to Malahide at some point. But are they going to go get asked back for a serious game at Lords or anywhere else anytime soon? I don't know. I'm not saying that they wouldn't, but it certainly increases the chances that they're going, well, what are we doing with these guys? They need to spend so much time. So does that then create a net positive, right? Then surely the game's a negative because the players have been put in such a bad position, and yes, day one with the bat, you could blame them, but when you don't blame day two with the ball, they don't blame the players. But what happens then? So once again, it's the heroics of someone like Andy McBride, who has bailed Irish cricket out so many times, and they've kind of gone, he's bailed himself and his team out of trouble in terms of saving face, but he's bailed his board out of trouble, because once again, his board have put him in a position where that he shouldn't be, and he's gone, right, well, we'll do just about enough here so that the board can be happy and go, oh yeah, this was a worthwhile exercise, where if they went home, or even arguably even worse, if they got bowled out inside an hour on day three and the MCC had to give out refunds to tickets, then there's another one where they're going, well, why the hell are we going to bring these guys back?
I get what you're saying. One thing I would say is that the negative of not playing might be more negative than the negative of playing. But the other thing I would say is, as someone who's been covering Ireland since 2007, the players do stand up, right?
Oh, 100%. And that's the thing. And that's the thing that I say in my piece. It's that, you know, it's kind of embedded into the nature of Irish cricket to not be prepared for anything. And it's equally embedded to completely outperform any expectations at all. And you're saying athletes all the time get thrown into situations that are not fair and not equal. And that's the story of Irish cricket. And like I said, even in white ball cricket, which they're actually decent at these days, or at least a lot better than they were, they're still not prepared anywhere near enough. They played a series in Zimbabwe in January and they still had no outdoor wickets to prepare on during the winter. So they were practicing on indoor, you know, fast bouncy nets as if they're going to go play in Perth or whatever, instead of, you know, Harare at 9 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. So even that. So
well, I mean, they just went to a World Cup that you covered them, and their death bowler was it Barry McCarthy, right?
There was the kind of the trio, him, Little and Adair.
Right. Well, McCarthy and Adair, both not death bowlers, right? And yet the team as a whole still, do you know what I mean? Like there's never going to be a perfect, I can't see there's ever going to be a time when Irish cricket on or off the field is going to be in a perfect situation. It is going to be a bunch of situations where you and I will always say they've been thrown to the wolves here, or they shouldn't be playing in this game, or they should be, you know, doing something else. But the reality of Irish cricket is that is what it is. That if you, the only reason you and I are sitting here chatting is because a mailman did something really good in a tournament, right? Do you know what I mean? It's the people who shouldn't have been good in the first place, who just kept fighting and fighting for Irish cricket. That is going to be the case. Now, maybe one day, I don't know, when I'm 110 and, you know, I don't know how much younger you are than me, but your 80 odd will be sitting somewhere and we'll be having the conversation of, now they're a normal team. But that's a long way off. So I agree with you, but I just think I don't think there's any way of fixing this, because they are always going to be in a situation where they're going to have to take what they can get. And that is all often going to be, you know, maybe not the meal that they wanted, but it's better than starving.
I'm not asking for perfect. I don't think we'll see a perfect Irish cricket setup in my lifetime.
And you're young.
I'm just saying that of all the examples, and you kind of touched on the romanticism of Andy McBride. Is he going to get 100 at Lords? All that, and that was a really nice bit of jeopardy on day three that everyone loved, and you know, Irish fans would love it. You know, Andy McBride's a really popular player in Ireland. They love that romanticism. Both of that and of Irish, you know, the plucky Irish team always outperforming expectations and outperforming their lack of preparation is part of Irish cricket. And I think that's actually important now, because it's something that the few fans that they do have, kind of grasp onto, and the players themselves grasp onto it, as much as the players would absolutely prefer to be playing in English systems for Ireland, if that makes sense. Or not necessarily English systems, but that standard, right? So I'm not discounting all that romanticism, and I think it's important. And it means people like me, when they win a World Cup game, can go nuts with the copy and go, you know, completely romantic style. And it, you know, they get the 10 minute slot on the top of the national news because it is romantic and it's nice. That's all important, right? I'm never going to ask demand for perfect. The players have to demand for perfect because they need to demand that they can do their jobs properly. Everyone knows it's not going to happen. My point is just this week was the worst I've seen it in terms of not having the perfect situation to throw their players into. And we've seen a lot of situations, like you said, we've listed lots here, where these guys have been, I wouldn't say thrown to the wolves because they've always been able to swim to a certain extent. But this is the first time in a long time I've seen it so bad that guys, through no fault of their own, have been thrown to the wolves and only, again, just kind of bailed themselves and they're bored out of trouble on day three.
Here's the best argument against your argument, which is if you had been in charge and you'd have cancelled the Lord's Test, Andy McBrien wouldn't have showed everyone how awesome he is. And so in some ways, this just goes on from the narrative of which I personally believe that you hate Andy McBrien, the pinch blocker. And I don't know why you hate him so much, but that's unfortunately, we're going to have to end the podcast and you're just going to have to be known as the Andy McBrien hater. And can't believe that that's who you are. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. There is more information on my guests in the show notes. Please support them where you can, but also support us. If you can't help out on Patreon, every single review, share, or word of mouth suggestion to your friend helps us. However, this podcast is made available by the people who support us at Patreon, so thank you to all of those who do. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. Red Inca is made by me, Jared Kimber. Nick McCorriston makes the best audio anyone can from random Zoom calls. We also have a great support team from 42, with Rati Joshi on socials, Orijoti Sainapia, and Maida Akam producing some of the shows, and Mukunda Banreddy as the head of YouTube content. Our theme tune is by the Red Crickets.